Hello and welcome to episode 9 of In Loco Parents, a podcast about parenting and lawyering in that order. I'm Karen Vladek.
I'm Steve Vladek, and it is Wednesday night, February 3rd, as we're recording this. It's our second episode of the week, and hopefully a little bit less downtrodden of an episode.
You seem stressed out, Steve.
A lot of things are sort of hitting and coming together, and today was a very busy day, and tomorrow's going to be a very busy day, and I'm in a little bit of mild panic at the moment about just how much there is, but as is always the case, I'll find a way through.
Yeah, I feel like we both have had a super busy week. Part of it was, as we talked about on our mini episode yesterday, we had a really horrible tragedy happen in our lives last week, and so I think both of us were very much down for the count last week in terms of being productive.
And just being like psychologically drained and exhausted.
Yeah, and so then this week is like, oh, right. You know, right before this, I definitely was scrambling to a second client email that was like, where is this again?
And I have a brief due on Monday, a paper draft due the following Tuesday. I have an oral argument next month. I have a business trip. That's weird.
Which I'm excited that you'll be fully vaccinated for.
Indeed. Yes, I will be fully vaccinated for my trip to go argue in D.C. before the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces, CAF.
You love that court.
I do. And this case actually is, we'll talk more about this case as we get closer. This is an issue that's been near and dear to my heart for a couple of years. And so finally having a chance to actually give an appellate argument about this thing that I've been briefing for 3 years is going to be quite the culmination.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Maybe we'll talk about that in your work wins part.
Okay. Well, it's not a win yet.
Yeah, that's true.
Getting the argument scheduled is like, hey, the case was docketed. anyway, but we wanted to, you know, as we promised in yesterday's mini episode, we did want to try to have at least some modicum of a return to normalcy, even if it's a bit of a front. I'm reminded in Hamilton, you know, after it's quiet uptown, mm-hmm. when they pivot to the election of 1800, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and Madison says, can we get back to politics? Mm-hmm. Or Jefferson says that, like, and Madison says, please.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I feel like, can we get back to less horrifying topics, like how we take care of our children and get through life? Mm-hmm. So today's episode, we actually have what I thought was a really, really interesting and I don't want to say fun because it was like, you know, depressing in many respects, but enlightening conversation with Mira Deo. Mira is a professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law in San Diego. She's doing this remarkably cutting edge work at the intersection of race and gender with regard to diversity in the legal academy. So we thought we might use that as a bit of a foil to talk about just our own experiences, mindful that I'm about the least diverse person I know.
Very tall.
I am tall. I bring vertical diversity, mm-hmm. To our faculty. But you know, I mean, this is my 17th year teaching. I've been on the hiring committee, I think 13 of my 17 years in the academy. So I have a lot of experience on both sides of that particular conversation. And, you know, obviously you have worked at, four law firms now in your career, right? You've been involved not just in the sort of hiring and job seeking phases of this, but you actually do employment law, where this is a big part of your substantive work. So we thought we'd talk a bit about our own experiences and our own sort of views on why it's so hard. Before, you know, leaving you to the real expert, Tamira.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know where to start. Where should we start?
It's such a broad topic. It's impossible to whittle down to a 20-minute discussion. True. I think some of the things that we can talk about, you know, I saw a thread from Jamie Santos today, and I wasn't sure where she was actually tweeting it from, but I saw that she said that there was something about why there's not as many women and minorities in the SCOTUS bar because of the pipeline, mm-hmm. right? And mm-hmm. if you look at the numbers that were in the 1990s, right, we're in the same, we're basically around the same in terms of elite appellate lawyers being, you know, being white men that aren't named Paul. So it's not a pipeline problem. That's the issue.
No, it's structural.
And so I've been thinking a lot about how...
It's not only a pipeline issue.
Yeah, I think saying it's a pipeline issue is...
Too convenient.
Is just a convenient thing to say, right? Because then it's somebody else's problem. Right. Well, I haven't done anything about it because there hasn't been the talent or there hasn't... the talent's there. And so I thought we would talk about some of the things that we as white people have a privilege to and how we can use our privilege to help diversify our own fields. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, one of the things that I've been thinking about for us, for our firm, is I am very fortunate to work at an incredibly diverse firm that really values diversity. But a few of the partners and I have decided that we are not going to bring on any more white males unless at the same time we're also bringing on mm-hmm. a diverse candidate, almost like a package deal. And I think that that's the only way for us to avoid a problem of there are some awesome, talented white males. I happen to be married to one. But unless I know, right?
You have two marriages.
But unless you are actively saying
right.
we are not going to allow our firm to become imbalanced, it is so easy to default to that hiring structure. One of the things that I tweeted out last week was, you know, you're in for a treat when you go to a website of an opposing counsel and it's all white men. Because it means that they're just not thinking about diversity, right?
And I think the problem is that, to me, there are multiple layers, right? One, there are the folks who just aren't thinking about it and aren't prioritizing it. Two, there are the people, and this has been, the second has been much more common in my appointments committee experience. There are the people who pay lip service to it, who say, yes, it's a real goal for me, like diversity is important, who, you know, make all the right overtures, but when push comes to shove, revert to behavior that really doesn't lend itself to diversifying the faculty. So, you know, they say, oh, well, as long as we're looking at the same number of male and female right. candidates for a position, that's diversity. To which my response right. is, well, no. First of all, because yield figures are radically different in the legal academy for male and female hires. That, you know, oftentimes you have to make offers to three times as many women candidates to land an equal number, right, in yield. But also it's like the notion is that my job is just to put a diverse slate on paper? No. I mean, it goes so much further. And at a school like Texas, I mean, I love Texas, but it is not an especially diverse faculty. And you don't diversify a faculty like ours by, you know, having equal slates of folks come through each year. I mean, that would be a marginal improvement, but it wouldn't be a structural improvement. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I was struck, you know, you and I both are very big fans of Denny Chin, the first Asian American federal appellate judge, and
he was the first Asian American appellate judge.
I think that's right. Yeah.
Really?
No, that can't be right. Judge Tang. No, Judge Tang. No,
there's way that that's right.
No, there's some statistic. He was the first. There's one. There's
maybe
one
district court judge.
I have to go back and look. There is some. He has some first that should never have been a first. Hmm. But anyway, so Denny, I've known Denny forever. Because Denny was a partner at my grandmother's law firm when I was a kid, when I was growing up. And so the news broke on Friday that Denny is taking senior status, which for non sort of law judge, you know, judge nerds, senior status is something you can take when you are when you're at least 65 and when the number of years you've been on the bench and your age adds up to 80, and it creates room for a new appointment. And so I tweeted in response to the news that Denny was coming out, was retiring. Like, Denny's amazing. I love Denny. You know, I've known him since he was a partner of my grandmother's firm. And all these people reacted like, wait, your grandmother's law firm? Say more. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I was struck by, like, you know, because my grandmother, spent a lot of her career both breaking barriers and complaining not about the fact that she was breaking the barriers, but the fact that, like, she was getting, like, you know, in 2003, when I was in law school, she got the ABA's Margaret Brent Award, which is the highest award the ABA gives to, quote, women lawyers. And the speech she gave at the convention accepting the award was about how there really shouldn't be an award for women lawyers.
Right.
And so I think, you know, I think there's just, like, there's all this, like, lip service that we pay to diversity. We say, oh, we're going to have awards. We're going to have special, we're going to have scholarships. We're going to have special privileges. And it's like, yeah, but the only way you actually really accomplish diversity is by doing it.
Yeah. And, like, I mean, another Hamilton quote, right? You have to be in the room where it happens, right? Mm-hmm. So unless hiring diverse associates doesn't do anything if those associates don't eventually end up on the management committee That's of right. your firm, That's right? right? Having a diversity scholar is great, only if that person then gets hired and moves up the ranks. So much of diversity comes from the top. And when you have management committees that are 100% white male, I don't care how many diverse associates you're hiring. It's not going to make a difference, right? And so I have seen, you know, we talk about this in Mira. We see in the law firm world now, big companies requiring diverse teams, not just to have diverse staff and have a picture that's diverse, but actually having a woman, a person of color, being the relationship partner, mm-hmm. getting credit for the matter. Those things are so important. I always say to people, what's one small thing that I can do? If, you know, some people might say, I work at a small firm. I don't have the ability to hire on all these people. Here's one small thing that every white male who's listening to this podcast can do, who is a lawyer. I know that you send out referrals to folks. When you're sending out a referral to another person, go to the website, see who you know at the firm. And I bet you in smaller legal markets like Austin, you probably know two or more people at that firm, even if your closest relationship is with a white male. Send that initial introductory email to that white male and to somebody else that is not a white male. Because guess what happens then? The origination gets split. Yeah. Simply because of the copy on the email. It is such a small thing. You're still going to get credit for sending the referral. You're still going to have a relationship and a pipeline with that person. You're just helping to spread the wealth a little bit. And that is actually something that takes pretty much zero effort. It's so disappointing to me when someone who I know knows that I'm at a firm and probably knows that the work's going to come to me too, and they're sending it to one of my male partners just to start, because then that's I'm losing 20 cents on that dollar right there. And I'm not saying don't send referrals to people that you have relationships with.
But the point is, every time you are connecting people, every yes. time you are making connections in your job, right? Don't just sort of default to the first name that pops into your head.
Absolutely.
I do that. So the place where this comes up the most on my end is not, you know, there's no origination in my business. But media requests.
Right.
I get a ton of media requests. I can't handle all of them. Two, I'm not the right person for many of them. And so, you know, I really consciously, when folks ask me, you know, when I have to turn down requests, I consciously try to suggest people who aren't just white guys mm-hmm. as alternative people. When I can't sit on a panel, right, I suggest people who aren't white guys. When I, you know, don't have time to review a paper. The problem, and we talk about this a bit with Mira, is that that's not a perfect solution, at least in the legal academy. And I think this is true in law firms too, although I obviously have less experience. It's not a perfect solution either, because you end up in this vicious cycle where the smaller number of, you know, diverse, whether it's women or people of color or other minorities, end up bearing a disproportionate burden of the work, right? Because we want them on all the committees. We want, you know, we want to show their face. We want them, you know, the students, at least in law school, right? Are, you know, a diverse student body is going to, you know, look for diverse faculty. And so that's going to put so much more of a pressure on the folks who look like the students. And I think, you know, obviously hiring is one way to solve that. But I think the other way is I say this a bit in our conversation with Mira, we ought to be thinking about carrots. Right, we ought to be thinking about rewarding the people who are bearing an increasingly disproportionate burden of that, you know, networking responsibility, of that service responsibility, of that mentoring responsibility, and not just sort of assuming they'll do it because they should. And I think that's, you know, part of the problem is that until and unless we get to a point where we really have reached meaningful diversity in the profession, the burden's going to fall disproportionately on, you know, the folks who in some ways are, you know, singled out because they don't look like me, right? Mm-hmm. Because they have different, you know, perspectives.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think, you know, we want to hear from you guys as listeners, who have been through process successfully recruiting, in a D&I framework, you know, what are things that I as a law firm partner can be doing? Mm-hmm. What are things that Steve as a professor can be doing? Mm-hmm. We are constantly trying to read and learn more and do our part.
And I think I think, you know, mindfulness is the first step. Just, you know, see it around you. Like, you know, be averse to, I'm now anti-Mannels, right? I just, yeah, it's hard, but it's like, it's people like us who have the, I think, a special responsibility to make sure. I mean, I have colleagues who I adore who just don't see it. Mm-hmm. Who just don't, you know, they don't see that, like, you know, we ask them for names of 10 people we should be looking at on the hiring committee, and they come back with 10 white guys. Mm-hmm. And they think there's nothing weird about that. You know, I've been on our speakers committee. Right. You know, the speakers committee, it seemed like so silly, right? Like, you know, a colloquium that's not at all appointments related, but this is how people get, you know, junior scholars, is how they get their names out there. Like, yeah. Don't just pick the fancy white guys from the fancy schools. I mean, I just, there's, you know, so much of this is structural, and like, no one person can overcome it by themselves, but that doesn't absolve us of the obligation to do what we can.
Absolutely. So. Absolutely.
The only upside of the COVID-related budget crisis that the University of Texas has faced over the last year is that we didn't have a hiring committee this year, so I didn't have to serve on it. Mm-hmm. That was a nice break.
I know that's always been something that's caused you a lot of stress. Both stress, but also enjoyment, because I think that you like advocating for, you are on the committee because you feel the obligation to advocate for folks.
Well, and because I have a dean who, even though he and I don't see eye to eye on many things, including, I think, in some cases where appointments priority should be, is not afraid to put people who he disagrees with on the hiring committee, which I think is a, you know, there are lots of things I admire about my dean, but that's actually right at the top of the list. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, as long as people are going to do the work, and as long as he thinks they're, you know, they've earned their spot, like, he's going to put people on the committee even if he wouldn't have made the same choices they would. Mm-hmm. But it's, you know, the flip side is, and then, I mean, just one last piece on the law professor side, even if everything goes perfectly, right, you still have to recruit. And Austin, right? I mean, I love Austin in any number of ways. Austin is not the most radically diverse city in the country.
It's hard.
Yeah. And so, you know, we've had multiple, in my 5 years at UT, right? This is my fifth year. We've had multiple, experiences where we've tried, where we've gotten exceptional candidates, you know, who don't look like me through the faculty, gotten the faculty to vote them offers, only to not be able to yield them, to not be able to recruit them successfully. And so it really is it never stops. Like, the recruiting is actually an important part of it too.
Austin suffers from the liberal on its face city problem, which is, it's a liberal city, so we don't have to work for things that, you know, of course we accept everybody and we're Democrats and whatever else, but what ends up happening is that it's a highly segregated city. There's a lot of cities, a lot of, you know, quote unquote liberal cities end up in that way.
That's right.
And so, yeah, I think it's, you know, we worry about it for our kids' education. Yes. We, you know, we seek out more diverse schools. We hope that, you know, where our kids end up, we'll have some diversity. And
I mean, we're going to talk in next week's episode about growing up in New York, mm-hmm. With our dear friend Lisa Rubin. But I will say, I mean, one of the things for which I am just always grateful about having had the opportunity to grow up as a kid in New York City, is just the extent to which you are exposed to all kinds of diversity when you go to New York City public schools. Not just diversity in your student body, but like, you're out in the world. Like, you know, you're not sheltered as a kid growing up in New York City. And so you're exposed to, you know, you see homeless people, right? I mean, I used to walk home through Washington Square Park in the 1980s, which was a drug den. You know, you get exposed to a lot. And I think that's something, one of my greatest fears as a parent is that we don't expose our kids to enough. And it's a tough line to walk, because, you know, you want to protect them, but you also don't want to insulate them.
No, it is really hard. I agree. Maybe that'll be in a future episode.
Indeed. All right. Should we, before, so we can get out of the way and let the actual expert on the topic have her say, should we talk briefly about parenting fail work win of the week?
Sure.
Do you have any?
The work win is that I was able to work this week.
work happened. I mean, hey, listen. I mean, shoot, Bubba, given the events of the last 8 days, that's a win.
Yeah, that was my win. Just being able to get out of bed and go to work. And I've been so, so busy. We're, you know, prepping for a trial. And so it's been a super busy time. And so that, just being able to do that, but it has been a win, I think. What was your work win?
I think my win is actually, this is going to sound really, really silly, but I think my win is successfully navigating the first week of classes.
Mm-hmm. Because you were on sabbatical last fall, so you didn't teach on Zoom.
I taught on Zoom at the end of last spring, yeah. But like those were classes that had met in person first. And so I had to like a rapport with the students. Like this was the first time I had started the semester on Zoom.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's really hard to tell when you're not seeing any of the students in person, but I feel like the first week plus of classes has gone pretty well.
Good. And you're going to be in person, right?
Next week. So, and then starting next week, I am quote, hybrid, unquote, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Which means I'm in person and students can come in if they want to. And the classrooms are set up to be socially distanced, mm-hmm. But it will also be synchronously taught via Zoom for the students who either are unable or unwilling to come in because of COVID. No judgments, no questions asked. I mean, it's just, you know, the whole point is to make it as seamless as possible for students to participate, whether they're in the room or online.
Cool. Are you looking forward to that?
So I'm looking forward to it in the sense that I think it will be a better experience, at least for the students who are able to come in person. I think it's actually going to be a lot harder for me.
Yeah.
Because it's one thing to sort of manage a Zoom session where all you have to do is watch the chat box and the participants tab and the little windows versus do that and manage a classroom in person. Mm-hmm. And I don't, you know, I think that's going to take more prep on my part. I think it's going to be more work and I have no experience doing it. So I have no confidence I'll be any good at it. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So that's next. So my win is like, okay, the Zoom only part of the semester has gone well. Now as we move toward the hybrid part of the semester. Eesh.
Yeah.
My only other work win, sorry, can I do one more work win before you turn and fails?
Of course.
This is how tired I am that it took me a minute to think about this. So I got invited today to testify at a congressional hearing. Mm-hmm. About the shadow docket, the Supreme Court's, yeah. You know, sort of this, something I've been working on and writing about for a while. But they proposed the hearing for Thursday afternoon, February 18th.
Okay.
And I was like, uh-oh, that's like right in the middle of my seminar. And I was like, I can't cancel my seminar. Like, I only have like 12 meetings of my seminar. Like, I don't, you know, I can't cancel it just to testify before Congress. And so I was literally starting to write back to the email about like why that time wasn't going to work for me and could do some other times. And I was like, I can't cancel my seminar about, oh, right, the shadow docket. And so I was like, why don't I just have seminar that day, be watching the congressional hearing?
There we go. Perfect.
Two birds, one stone.
That is seriously killing two birds with one stone.
It's just the sad part is like that it didn't occur to me. Like I was literally in the middle of writing the email about why I couldn't make it work when it occurred to me.
Right,
like,
because your seminar is the shadow docket, right?
And so like, but that's just, that's how spaced out and like stressed out and just not functioning my brain is right now.
I know.
So parenting fails?
I'm trying to think of my parents. So my parenting fail this week was we went on Sunday morning. Maddie, Sydney, and I went to go meet up with our friends, Kathleen and Matt, at this amazing park called Park for All Abilities in Round Rock. If you're in the Austin area and you haven't been, it's fantastic. So we're there. And of course, I'm like trying to juggle both of them. And Kathleen was being a great help to me. And so was Matt. And Maddie decided to stand up on this, which is very unlike her, but she stood up on top of this table and like that, you know, that boat thing that they have there.
Yeah, the boat that rocks.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so she stood up on this table and said, "Mommy, is this safe?" And I, like, which is really not like her. She's not really like
adventurous
like that. And so I walk over and this thing, the boat rocks when you stand on it. So I walk on it. She fell off the table. And she has been complaining about her butt for 5 days.
I mean, she basically bruised her tailbone.
Yeah. And so I don't know if that's really – I don't know how I could have stopped it. I guess – now, she wants to blame me because she said I rocked the table. Meanwhile, she was standing on a table. So I'm going to go with a parenting 50-50 and blame half of it on my child.
Parenting child fail.
Yeah. But so mostly it was a fail because now she keeps complaining about her butt. And so we've been reading about like bruising the tailbone and what that all means. But she's still complaining. So that's mine. Do you have one?
Yeah. I mean, mine is actually a pretty recurring one. I don't think it's especially high on the list of terrible parenting things I do, but it's not my best move, which is I don't always think through when it's appropriate to discuss logistics in front of the girls and when it's not. Karen is rolling her eyes at me right now. So that confirms that I've chosen correctly in my parenting fail for the week. And so, you know, I sometimes just say things to Karen because I had been thinking about them or I'd forgotten about them. It popped into my head without realizing that Maddie, who is five, hears everything, processes everything, and has an opinion about every logistical thing ever.
Ever.
So we were
talking about like President's Day when they don't have school.
Right.
And Maddie Steve's got, like, right. Oh, I have an idea about what to do with them that day. And then we hadn't talked about it. Like, right. We hadn't planned out the day.
I hadn't seen you all day. So, like, this was me catching up with you. The only problem is I was catching up with you in front of Maddie.
I know.
Which is, that's my recurring mistake is trying to catch up with you in front of Maddie.
Yeah, you can't. You have to do it, like, after they go to sleep. But it is, you know.
By which point we're both exhausted.
Right. We see each other at the very end of the day when they're both.
And the only energy we have left is for Spell and me.
That's true.
Lollygagging.
No one knows what we're talking about.
I would be willing to bet that a fair number of our listeners know exactly what we're talking about.
There have been some good spelling bees this week.
There have been. Lollygagging was just, that was, there were too many points. So my fail is just sort of having conversations in front of Maddie that are not sensitive. They're just, they provoke her unnecessarily. Like, because then what happened was she was really upset that I wouldn't tell her what the plan was.
Exactly.
And so then I had to basically invent
like,
a plan.
We're going to get ice cream. And like, he just started saying all these things that she likes to do and that assuaged her. And then I looked at him and I was like, now you know you have to do all those things,
but
right?
But no, because my plan, because the thing about Maddie is Maddie doesn't care if you change the plans as long as the new plan is better than the old
plan.
And I knew the new plan, I knew what my actual plan was, which I didn't want to talk about in front of her, was definitely better than what I had faux promised her. Yeah. And so I knew I would get no trouble for saying all of that.
That's true.
All right. We should get out of the way and get to our interview with Mira. Yes. And we'll be back at the end to wrap it up. But for now, here is our interview with the fantastic Mira Deo. All right. Well, I'm really excited to introduce our very special guest for today, Dr. Mira Deo, who's the director of the Law School Survey of Student Engagement, professor of law at Thomas Jefferson School of Law in beautiful San Diego, and the William Newcomb Fellows Research Chair in Diversity in Law at the American Bar Foundation. Mira's research merges jurisprudence with empirical methods to interrogate institutional diversity, affirmative action, and racial representation. Her fantastic book, Unequal Profession, Race and Gender in Legal Academia, published by Stanford in 2019, draws from her landmark Diversity in Legal Academia project. It examines how the intersection of race, gender affect interactions with faculty and students, tenure and promotion, work-life balance, and so many other pretty important aspects of the law faculty experience. And one of her current projects investigates the COVID effects on diversity, equity, and inclusion in legal academia, especially for women faculty. Another work in progress considers how empirical data can inspire improvements to contemporary affirmative action policies. So all of this really important cutting edge work. Mira, we are so excited to welcome you to In Loco Parents.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So we like to start our every interview by actually starting with the kids. So tell us a little bit about your kids.
Sure. My kids are 11 years old and 9 years old. They are just old enough now to manage a lot of homeschooling on their own this year, or Zoom schooling. But they're also old enough to really miss the independence that they were just starting to appreciate. I think for many of our kids, that's sort of disappeared over the past year, especially for kind of the tween and teen kids. One of them's in elementary school and the other one's in middle school. And so that has its own challenges.
Are they totally home/zooming right now? Is there any in-person stuff going on?
Yeah. So, here in Southern California, we started off the fall from home. And then I think in October, schools opened up. And of course, just to make it as complicated as possible for us parents, both of our kids are going 50% time, but the 50% for elementary school does not match the 50% for middle school. So
of course.
I'm just driving a lot. I'm just driving around a lot. Because they're only going to school for a few hours every day and there's some overlap, which is great, but it's not the same hours every day. They're actually home now. The numbers have been so bad here locally that we haven't been sending them lately. So hopefully they'll go back in a few weeks. They really miss seeing everyone, being with their friends, and, you know, learning is hard when we're not in person, as Steve, as you know, I'm sure from teaching, it's difficult for law students. And so it's obviously even more complicated for littles.
Yeah. So we didn't, in your bio, we didn't talk about what you did before the academy, but where were you before the academy? And at what point in that process did you have kids?
So I have a JD and a PhD, and most people who do both do the PhD first and then pursue a law degree. And I did it sort of the backwards way. I went to law school, practiced law, and then entered a PhD program in sociology. And my kids came after all of that. And so I was actually pregnant while I was on the law teaching market, which I don't necessarily recommend. I remember I was flying a lot, you know, for the initial DC interviews. For listeners who don't know, there's a very formal interview process for law teaching, and there's a conference, I think they call it, in DC, where you do these short interviews with a bunch of schools and then the schools that want you. And if you want them too, then you fly back for a day or two to spend with those schools. And so I was doing a lot of flying relatively early in my pregnancy. And I remember at some point calling my doctor and saying, like, I'm really tired. I don't know. I think something might be wrong. And the doctor's like, well, what have you been doing lately? And I explained my schedule. The doctor was like, oh, you're fatigued.
was that a clinical diagnosis?
Right, exactly. You know, he was just like, you could be not pregnant and have a schedule like that and still feel kind of out of sorts. So yeah, I think I was probably not so obviously pregnant early on, and then much more likely more visibly pregnant towards the end. So that's actually the year that I was finishing my dissertation as well. So I was on the market while I was finishing writing and pregnant. So it was kind of a hectic year. My son was born a couple weeks early as well. And so the first course I ever taught in law school was civil procedure, which I still teach, which I still love to teach. I think my son was probably 10 weeks old when I started.
That's one thing. I'm obviously not in legal academia, but I've observed a lot of women go through the maternity leave process, and it does seem so inequitable. Like it's just like not a written rule. At least at the two schools Steve's been at, there was no like one way, yeah, you get X off. It was just kind of like, oh, if you happen to have a baby now and you can get a course release, like you'll get maternity leave. But if not, you're expected back.
And just like in practice, which, you know, when things aren't written down and formally arranged, they're applied inequitably too. And so like in my research, for example, I talked to men who were really frustrated that they didn't get leave, even though women who were pregnant when they were, you know, like there's one man who I talked to who was really frustrated that his wife was pregnant at the same time as a female colleague of his. And she immediately was granted maternity leave, and he asked for parental leave and it was denied. Which, you know, it's sort of applied in this inequitable sense. Or even for me, you know, when I started teaching there, a woman who had been at the law school before I started was pregnant as well. And she was on maternity leave my very first semester teaching. And it didn't even occur to me to ask for leave. Another woman in the research that I've done was in a similar situation to what I was in. She was pregnant on the market, and she just assumed she would start teaching, you know, as soon as she was hired. And it was her second child. And she told me in our interview that women faculty at the school she was going to start at, in her words, staged an intervention where they told her, you cannot start teaching. Even if you feel like you can do it, you owe it to the people who will come after you to take this time off, and we'll give it to you. So you don't need to fight for it or anything. We will arrange it for you. It's no problem. But more people taking these opportunities creates sort of a norm for doing it for women and for men.
Yeah. We just went through that at UT because we had our second, when Steve was in his second year there, and his first go around when we had our first in American, he took off like a week and it was so stressful and awful. And I said, you have to push for leave, if nothing else, because then the next woman who comes behind you can say, you guys gave Steve Wadick a whole semester off. You're giving me a whole semester off. And that puts them in a better negotiating standpoint. And it was interesting because actually Steve got a lot of, I'm not allowed to swear on this podcast. Steve tells me I'm not allowed to, but he got a lot of flack for taking leave, which I thought was interesting because I was like, it's,
but flack from older women faculty members.
Yeah. It was sadly older women who I totally understand were in a position where they didn't get it. But I was like, the only way they were going to have change is if it's across the board, right? Because women can't fight this battle by themselves.
Absolutely. And you know,
I'm sorry, Mira, please.
No, it's just, it gets complicated too, because, you know, we've seen research that shows that when men take leave, it's often later. The kids tend to be a little bit older, maybe sleeping through the night. They're often not the primary caregiver at the time that they're taking leave. And it, from my perspective, at least, that doesn't mean that they shouldn't take it. There's still a tremendous opportunity, I think, to be gained from bonding with your child, whether the child is 2 weeks old or 6 months old. But for academics, that can often create additional problems because then, you know, the women who are taking leave are usually taking it at the very beginning. They're not doing any work at all while they're on leave. They're just physically recovering, frankly, and, you know, figuring out how to deal with a screaming, not sleeping baby. And so I think for some of those women, they get frustrated too, because as we've seen that the research shows that sometimes when men are taking leave, they're able to actually be very productive during that time. And so I think a lot of this just depends on recognizing how some of those challenges are different for people from different backgrounds, from people who have different responsibilities, and then being flexible about those.
And different family situations. I mean, I think it's a, you know, it's, I think it's a very big difference when it's you and your partner and nobody else versus, you know, when you actually have family in the area, when you have a support network. I mean, I think this is why I get really nervous when, like, faculty hiring committees or faculty tenure committees try to make broad generalizations about, you know, oh, there was a gap of, you know, this person didn't really produce any scholarship during this period. And then, you know, it's like, well, there are any number of entirely legitimate, like, appropriate reasons why that gap might be there. We should not make inferences about it.
Absolutely. Right. I mean, let alone someone who's doing it on her own without a partner. Right. So there's always things I think that we can take into consideration to understand the experience better.
So I want to come back to the sort of the broader defects in diversity in the academy, but you said something that I wanted to also touch on, which was in many respects, you did things not backwards, but sort of the opposite of normal, right? You did your JD first, then your PhD. And I'm curious, was your plan always to do the PhD? Was there something that happened along the way that pushed you into that program? And, you know, was it lawyer first and sociologist second? Or it's interesting.
Yeah. So, like most of the women in my research, I'd never had a plan to join legal academia. It wasn't my plan when I was in law school. It wasn't my plan when I was in practice. It wasn't even my plan when I was in graduate school, to be honest. I loved my PhD program in sociology, and I found that I had a lot of different things that I was curious about or interested about. And I thought I could study a number of different things sociologically. And so I thought I would go into a sociology department as an academic. And then a few law professors talked me out of that. Jerry Kong, especially, who convinced me that, you know, being behind the podium is very different than being a student. And Devin Carbato, who was on my dissertation committee actually a number of years ago, he also thought it would be, you know, at least worth considering. And they were right. I mean, it is certainly a different type of lifestyle being a law professor than being a sociology professor. That I think it's easier to get tenure. The clock is shorter. The pay is better. There's just a lot of pluses, I think, to legal academia, but it certainly wasn't my plan early on.
Do you have a follow up? And was it while you were still in the program, or was it once you had finished your dissertation that you decided legal academy?
Yeah. You know, what's strange about it is that, you know, I say that they convinced me and they did. But I sort of thought, let me take a look anyway at the sociology market and see what's out there. And part of what they, what, you know, most of my mentors, both in law and in socials, in sociology, told me is that because there were so many reasons to go into legal academia as compared to sociology, that I wouldn't get as much interest from sociology departments either, that, you know, people who were hiring for sociology would essentially expect that I wouldn't be that interested in them if I could get a law teaching job. And so I got a lot more interest from law schools than I did from sociology departments too. So it was kind of a confluence of factors, I guess, because like even
it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy, right?
Yes, I guess. Right. Because I think they expect, you know, that's what most of us will do if we're considering both markets. And then we do kind of end up going that way.
So, Mary, you're pretty much like the leading authority on diversity in the legal academy, or the unfortunate lack thereof. Can you say a bit about what drew you to that particular topic? And then I have a bunch of follow-up questions on that, but let's start with what drew you to that particular topic.
Yeah. So, you know, when I started law teaching, I kind of looked around to get a sense of who else was out there. And, you know, I didn't see any data necessarily, but, you know, even anecdotally, you can tell that it's not an especially diverse, not just profession, but, you know, sort of niche area of the profession. Mm-hmm. And because I'm a sociologist and I had been doing research on law students already for a number of years as part of my dissertation work, and then early in my career as a law professor, I figured I would look around and see what data I could find. I'm always sort of trying to empirically answer questions, you know, to get a sense of whether what the patterns that I tend to notice are actually quantifiable. And so I looked for that data and I really didn't find much. AALS, which is the main sort of membership body for American law schools, used to collect this data and share it, but they haven't actually released the data since I started in law teaching, which was in 2009. So the very little data that we have is really outdated. And also it's purely numerical. So again, as a social scientist, my research has almost always been mixed method, which means that I'm usually combining survey data with interview data. Or focus group data. And so for me, I do that because I think survey data is just a great way to answer what is going on. You know, you ask 100 people or 1,000 people to check a number of boxes, and then you can sort of add all of those together and count up what's happening. But it's not especially good at explaining why things are happening, because you're just asking people to check boxes. And so the research that I do tends to incorporate both survey data and interview or focus group data so that I can actually talk to people and get a sense from their own voices and their own perspectives why things are the way they are. And so there really hadn't been any qualitative data, any interview data with faculty members at all, as far as I could tell. And so that's why I started doing the research that I have been working on now for the last 5 or 8 years, that sort of lays the foundation for the book that, Steve, I think you mentioned earlier, and that sort of leads to the research that I'm still doing now about faculty members under COVID.
And so what, and this is probably... I'm trying to ask you to distill years of research down into a 3-minute answer. And so you can just tell me, well, everyone can read my book, which we all will. But what, like, if you were to pick the top maybe 3 or 4 things that the Academy could be doing better as a whole, what can and what should they be doing?
So, you know, there is a numbers problem, first of all. And so from the data that I just mentioned, that's outdated, but it's all we've got. From even if we just look at that data, there are around 7% of all law professors are women of color. And that's compared to about 25% white women and around 50%, maybe 46% white men. I'm not really sure again, what the numbers are. And so the numbers are small. So that's, I think it's an initial problem. A lot of schools have invited me to consult with them on hiring practices, especially this year after the George Floyd protests and Black Lives Matter. There's been, I think, a renewed interest for law schools in paying attention to issues of diversity, equity, and inclusion, and recognizing that law schools have a role to play and we can all do better in this regard. And so a lot of schools have been interested in my sharing sort of strategies or ideas for how to improve hiring. So that's one issue for sure. But just like with admissions, if you know, there's been so much more research on law students or students in higher education generally with regard to issues of diversity. Generally, the focus, especially for lawyers and for people who study affirmative action or these types of issues, the focus is always on admissions, on how you can get in the door. But we tend sometimes, because we're so hyper focused on admissions or on recruiting or on hiring, we're kind of missing what happens afterwards. And there is certainly an attrition problem or a retention problem for faculty of color and especially for women of color faculty as well. And so, there in terms of, thinking about a few different issues or problems that come up, the retention problem has a number of challenges within it. One of them that faculty members and students generally really are interested in talking about deals with student evaluations. There's a lot of research showing that there's sort of inherent bias within student evaluations that people like a charming actor who's sort of spouting gibberish is more likely to get higher results than a very competent person who is sort of outside of the norm of what the students expect in terms of who the professor should be, or, someone who looks different than what most of their other professors look like. And so my favorite example of ways that we can think, more broadly or creatively about student evaluations is that, every school I've taught at has a question on the student evaluation, some version of, rate, some version where they're expected to rate the professor's mastery of the material. Now, all my students in civil procedure know about civil procedure is literally what I've taught them over 14 weeks.
Totally.
And yeah. So we're asking them to decide if I really know my stuff, right?
Yeah.
I think it would make a lot more sense to ask students to share whether the professor, the level at which the professor treats students with respect or the professor's ability to elicit a useful conversation in the classroom or draw on context to help explain the law, right? There's so many things that students really could explain well, where they're sitting there, for so many hours over the course of a semester. Let's ask them questions that they can actually answer well. And hopefully things that we really do care a lot about so that we can get a better perspective on what the student experience is like and also so that we can better evaluate professors. Because, at a lot of schools, administrators use those evaluations to make really important career decisions about tenure and promotion and bonuses and things that can honestly just break a career for particular faculty members.
Mm-hmm. I've always thought that it is especially inequitable to do evaluations at the end of the first semester when, back to the point, right? Does the professor have mastery of the material? At the end of their first semester of law school, law students have no idea what other law professors are like. And so, someone might be relatively, right, the least impressive of their faculty members from that semester and the fourth best professor they're going to have in their entire law school career.
Right, right.
But we never go back to them and say, hey, now that you've actually been in law school for a while, what do you think about the professors you had back then? Like, has your opinion changed? Do you think even more highly of them? And so there's also, and I wonder if you found that this also further skews the data, because at least the three law schools I've taught at, minority faculty tend to be disproportionately dispatched to required classes because, partly because they're fantastic teachers, but partly because, the schools want to show as much as possible what diversity they have, insufficient though it may be. And so they actually end up teaching a disproportionate percentage of required first year courses, required upper class electives, which then further sort of reinforces the skew in the evaluations.
I think that's absolutely right. And it sort of lends itself to another issue in response to your question a moment ago, Karen, about what some of the big issues are. There is an inequitable distribution of responsibilities, even among faculty members who are, you know, for the most part, expected to be treated relatively similarly. So even if faculty members have, let's say, two or three service committee responsibilities, women of color faculty members are much more likely to serve repeatedly on admissions, on recruitment, on diversity committees, on any sort of university-wide committees for the reason, Steve, that you're mentioning, which is that schools understandably do want to signal that they have a commitment to diversity and that they're putting faculty members from diverse backgrounds on not just, you know, committees where they want to showcase diversity, but committees that do have real power. So, you know, that's not to say that schools are faking it by putting people from diverse backgrounds on these committees. I think often they do want to put people it's in genuine. A position where they can have a voice. Right. But of course, that depends on making sure that they have a voice to share. There's also, you know, it's been interesting for me to find that sometimes women, especially junior faculty, don't want to be on these committees. You know, they are trying to focus on getting their scholarship done. That's going to be what they're rewarded for when it comes time for tenure and promotion. And so it's easy for them to get sidetracked because there is so much service work. And that's the formal service work, let alone, you know, the intensive meetings with students and being the advisor for different student groups and moot court and, you know, all of the informal mentoring that happens with students as well.
So I want to tie this to the legal profession more generally, but I have one more question because we could do this all day. I mean, this is my 17th year teaching. I've been on appointments 13 times in 17 years. Right. And I think appointments is one of the committees where this is most, you know, sort of, I've always thought, and I'm curious what, if this is something you've thought about in your research and if not, if I'm just stupid, you can tell me why. I've always thought that one of the ways while you are trying to ameliorate the gap and to increase diversity, while also having committees that are more diverse than the faculty at large, one of the ways to potentially do that is to actually create better incentives, right, for that kind of service work, right? That, you know, I mean, at American, for example, there were no incentives at all for being on committees. Like you had to do it, but like there was, you know, being chair of a committee didn't mean you got a course release. Right. You know, there was no monetary consideration. There was no teaching consideration. And so I'm curious if there's a way to sort of lighten the, you know, insofar as we're going to impose an unduly heavy burden on women faculty, on faculty of color, on the service side, should law schools be thinking about ways of lightening the load elsewhere?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that's one of the findings that's, I think, easiest to implement from my book. If we are institutionally valuing certain things that people do, then let's recognize and reward them for the things they're doing. One of the women I interviewed is at a school where they get a bonus for a placement in a prominent law review.
No one can see, but you should see Steve's face right now.
It's sort of horror and disgust.
Thinking about all the thousands of dollars that you've lost by not being there, right?
No, I'm thinking about how much power that gives to 2Ls.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, we could have a whole other session another time if you want, just about law reviews and submissions. Yes. I have lots of ideas about that too. But this one particular interview, a woman told me, why don't we get compensated for service work the way we get a bonus for an article that lands at Yale Law Journal? And so, you know, obviously there are real institutional benefits to this service work. The women who spend hours every week talking to students who are crying and wondering if they should drop out of school, you know, if you're convincing a student to stick around and, you know, making clear to them that you believe in them, that they can do it. There's research that shows not only that they're more likely to stay in law school, but they're actually more likely to pass the bar exam too, because they know that their professors believe in them.
To think highly of their law school, right? And to be productive and supportive alumni.
Exactly. And so, you know, there are many reasons for the school to support faculty members who are making that investment in their students. we haven't talked that much about LESSE yet, the Law School Survey of Student Engagement, but this is the national survey project that I run. It's based at Indiana University. And we've been collecting data from law students in partnership with law schools for, this is our 17th year, and only my third year as director. But, you know, through that data, we know how important it is for students to value the relationships they have with their professors and how much that can make a difference in terms of their professional success as well as their academic success. And so, you know, schools that are undervaluing the service work that professors provide, and often that is women of color professors, are really not recognizing the benefits to them as a school. And, you know, it's, Steve, you were talking about kind of recognizing that service work. And it goes, I think, beyond equitably distributing the load, because there are a lot of women who enjoy doing the service work. You know, there are certainly people who are like, I don't want to be on the recruitment committee again. Mm-hmm. But there are also plenty of people who really love having those opportunities to meet with students, to really support students. And so it's less a question of let's make sure they don't have to do that work, because some of them enjoy doing it. And it's much more, I think, about valuing what they're doing, because it has so many benefits, not only for individual students, but as you've said, for the institution as a whole, long term, in terms of the return on the investment that's going to come back to the school as well.
It reminds me so much.
I'm sorry,
it reminds me so much of, in the big law context, the disproportionate amount of service work that women have to do that goes uncompensated, and particularly women of color who are put on committees, and that at the end of the day, you'd be shocked to find out that it's all about your bottom line and how you're compensated, right? It's not how many touchy-feely committees did you serve on.
I'm sorry, Mira.
I'll just say that, because we haven't talked about legal practice yet, but I do a lot of CLEs, for example, for law firms that draw from this research on law students and on legal academics and translate it to the context of legal practice, because the issues are almost exact. Numbers are actually very similar. So usually when I show these slides, I show, you know, what the percentages are for faculty, but also I show what they are for associates and for partners. And, you know, the numbers are similar, the challenges are similar, both with recruiting and with regard to retention. And so I would expect that a lot of the things that you read about in the book or that we're talking about now are things that, you know, you personally, Karen, have experienced, or certainly things that you've seen in your years of practice too.
But, I mean, that was going to be my next question, which was, you know, obviously we see this reflected in legal practice as well. Which is the chicken and which is the egg? Right. Like, I mean, you know, do you think that reforms on the academic side would translate into reforms in the legal practice market, or vice versa? Or is it sort of two similar problems that have two different sets of solutions in your, you know, halcyon worldview?
Yeah. So, you know, what's been interesting for me in the last few years is, you know, as an outsider in terms of someone who is in legal academia, not practicing, but a lot of my classmates from law school are in practice. As an outsider, you know, I read things in the paper about how firms are being really pushed to focus more on issues of diversity, equity, and inclusion by their clients. That, you know, large corporations are saying, you have to staff our matters in a more diverse fashion. We want more women. We want more attorneys of color working on our matters. When I first saw that happening, honestly, I called my law school roommate, who's a partner at a law firm, and I was like, is this for real? Because I wasn't sure. You know, is this hype or is this actually a commitment to change? And she assured me that it is real. And I think that has continued in the last 2 to 4 years, where there's more and more a commitment among clients to ensure that firms are thinking a little bit more about diversity and about diverse hiring and about diverse staffing. I don't know, Karen, if you've seen that in your experience, but I've been asking because I'm hopeful that that's true, that it isn't just hype, and it sure seems like it is real.
Yeah, I think you're seeing it more and more about particular clients, particularly the larger ones, right? The Googles, the Facebooks, requiring, and this is where I think it's really important, right? Not just a diverse team, but that a person of color or a woman is getting actual origination credit on the matter, which is really where the change comes, right? Because you can always staff, say, oh, there's a diverse person who's on the team somewhere. But at the end of the day, it's the person who is making the origination, who's a relationship partner who's getting credit for that, where you're really moving the ball forward. And so I do think it's those, you know, those contracts saying we need to have a diverse team. By taking it one step further, and one thing that I always say to people, when you're making a referral, if you know a woman, if you know a person of color at the firm, copy them on the email. So much of the origination of a matter comes from just who happened to get the email at the firm. You know what I mean? Which is such a ridiculous way of doing it. But that's just how, you know, the world works in law firms. And if you have a firm that does origination, not all firms do origination, but like copy the woman. Guess what? It gets split 10-10 then if you do a 20% origination, right?
Oh, I love that. My favorite examples of solutions are things that are relatively simple things that can have a really big impact.
Yep. So simple, especially because it's like, especially, so I do employment and then it's like, someone will email a male partner of mine that's like, I need employment help. And the fact that the partner got the email and then forwards it to me, like I just lost 20 cents on the dollar, right? Yeah. Whereas, but I mean, it happens the other way around too. Like I'll get an email that says I need corporate help and I'll forward that along. And then I got 20 cents on the dollar, but women need a little bit more help.
Yeah. I mean, there's a longer history of discrimination, right?
100%. Yeah. Yeah. Mira, I know I can tell from Steve's face that he wants to do this all day, but we both promised you that we wouldn't keep you for too long. And I know you're so triple booked. So we just have a couple quick questions. And we'd like to sort of pivot back to, parenting, which is a lot of people wonder how working parents with these big jobs and you're doing all this consulting work and your book and you're teaching and everything handle it. So do you have any tips or tricks that you've picked up along the way for our listeners?
Are there three of you?
Tips or tricks? No, there's only me. I don't know if I have tips or tricks. I got some advice early in my law teaching career from Phoebe Ellsworth, who was a professor of mine at Michigan when I was a student. And she told me, because as I mentioned, you know, my son was born right before I started teaching. So I was sort of learning how to be a parent at literally the exact same time that I was learning how to be a law professor. And she told me there will be days when your kids are awful. Mm-hmm. And you can escape them into your work, you know, like it's okay to like be more excited about your work. And there are days when like your class is just going to bomb. It's not going to work the way you thought or where you thought you'd get a lot of writing done and it's not happening. And on those days you can take solace in your kids. And so it's been interesting to think about that balance, as long as it's not all falling apart at the same time, right? Then it's okay to sort of rebalance. One of the women I've talked with for my interviews similarly had this sort of interesting take on balancing by like looking bigger picture. You know, she was like, basically every day I'm falling short. You know, I'm not being a perfect wife or mother or professor. It's not always ideal. But if I, instead of thinking about it for the day, if I think about it in terms of a week or a month, then that sort of gives her a little flexibility, a little space to like, okay, yesterday I didn't get nearly as much done as I hoped to with regard to work, but I got to play with my kids and that was great. And so today and tomorrow and the next day, you know, I'm probably not cooking dinner, yes. Probably not going to the park, but I'm going to get a lot of writing done. And so, you know, instead of every night when you go to bed thinking like, did I succeed in all these different areas, we can, you know, give ourselves a little bit of grace and extend the timeline to think more broadly about whether things are working. And I honestly, I think that's more true now than it ever has been. I think in the intro, Steve, you mentioned that the research I'm doing now is with faculty members about the past year, what the past year has been like. The focus of this particular research is with junior faculty members and especially women of color. And I'm including people who are not on the tenure track because people in contract positions, for example, have even less security usually than others. And it has been just a tremendous struggle. You know, imagine if it, when it's been hard for me, right, as someone who is relatively secure, tenured, been doing this for a long time. Imagine for a junior faculty member. Like, there's one woman I spoke with who was in her first year of teaching. And this relates again back to the point we were making earlier about having like written rules that are applied equitably to everyone. This woman is in her very first year of teaching, and she is struggling to the extent that she told me she is pulling two all-nighters every week.
What?
Just to get her teaching together. She doesn't have anything ready to submit for the next submission cycle for publications. And for junior scholars, you know, this is obviously a dream job for many, many people. Yeah. The scary part of it is that, you know, you kind of, you have these 4 to 6 years to prove yourself. And if you don't, you don't have a job. And so she feels just a tremendous amount of pressure because she hasn't produced where she thought she would. She has a toddler at home. Another woman I spoke with in one of my recent interviews about COVID was like, you know, yes, I have, you know, someone who's around to help with my two kids, but one of them is an infant. So she's like, if you're breastfeeding, it doesn't matter who else is around. Like, you're basically tied to your kid no matter what. And so, you know, this year especially, I think it's just been such a struggle for everyone, honestly. And even for people who have the privilege of, you know, being employed, who have a strong educational background, a roof over their heads and enough food to eat, there's still just a tremendous amount of pressure. And that has really created a lot of significant mental health effects too, just in terms of loneliness, not having time alone, significant anxiety and stress. So I'm really hoping to work more with administrators and institutional partners to immediately try to put some changes into effect.
Well, we have a lot of work to do, but I'm very happy that you're doing it, and I hope people listen.
Yeah, me too. You're so amazing. Did I just fangirl you a little bit? But honestly, I'm just loving listening to you. It's so, I'm like, oh, can we keep going for like 17 hours? Because you're so interesting. This research is so amazing. It's so pivotal. It's applicable across all different areas, not just in the academy. I'm hearing so many things about my own career, and just, it's so interesting to me. So
why don't we at least plug Mira's book again?
Yeah. Yes.
Right. So Mira's book is Unequal Profession, Race and Gender in Legal Academia, from Stanford University Press. And listeners can take 20% off the book with the code DEO20, DEO20, at the Stanford University Press website. Mira, you guys can find her on Twitter at Mira Deo, an excellent follow, one of my favorites. And I just, you know, we might have to just have you back and just do this again. Because
we're going to do a part two with you. You're going to be our first guest, and you're coming back for a part two.
I love it. Well, we have lots to talk about.
We really do. Mira Deo, thank you so much for taking the time. It was great to at least begin this conversation with you, but I hope we will get to continue it in the future.
Same. Thank you for having me on.
Man, I feel like that could have gone on for like an hour and a half.
So I'm actually obsessed with her.
I know. What? Really? I'm sure the listeners could not tell.
I actually said I love you to her when we hung up the phone.
True story.
Or when we hung up the Zoom, I should say.
True. I was there.
And she was very kind about it. But I really...
She did not comment on your awkwardness.
I like basically want to just turn this into the Mira Deo podcast where we just have interviews with her every week. She was so calming.
Yeah.
And so amazing and so bright and had so many insights on things. And I just loved it. So next week, as Steve mentioned, we are going to have on our friend and
my law school classmate and the progenitor of this podcast,
Lisa Rubin.
Without whom there would be no In Loco Parents.
I agree. I think that that's 100% right.
Yep.
And hopefully we'll have slept a little bit more by then. And in the meanwhile, you can find us on Twitter at In Loco Parents. You can find us on Instagram at
In Loco Parents Pod.
You can email us at inlocoparentspod@gmail.com. We really love getting your emails. You can send us messages at our work accounts. You can DM us on Twitter. There's so many different ways to
to find us, to communicate.
Send a carrier pigeon, smoke signals, whatever.
Someone called me the other day to ask if they could pass along my contact information to somebody else.
Uh-huh.
I was like, you've seriously just occupied 2 minutes of your time and 2 minutes of mine to ask if you can give someone information that they could have found in 10 seconds on Google.
100%. 100%. That's like when people are like, you guys share too much information on the internet. And I'm like, so much of what we share is already, you could just find that on Google. Our emails, our phone numbers, like you can find all that stuff on the internet. It's not
Travis County tax records. Hidden.
Yeah.
Anyway, on that note.
So please reach out, join our Patreon.
Review the podcast on the Apple Podcast or Google Podcast, wherever you do, you know, all the stuff. All right. And we will soon be doing our second Patreon bonus episode. So if you have particular ideas about what we should talk about in bonus episode number 2, we'd love to hear those. Until then, we will talk to you guys next week. Happy parenting.
Bye, y'all.